A long time ago, on a gloomy, wet Cleveland spring night, two men stand alone amidst the late-night drizzle. Their voices echo across the vacant station parking lot as they debate the merits of the great American radio show that have been missing for far too long. On that night, an idea was born. That idea became the FDH Lounge. Welcome to the FDH Lounge.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the FDH Lounge. I want to thank our good friends at Sportsology once again for hosting us here on this platform, as they've been doing on many occasions recently when we've had guests. I want to thank them so much, Russ Cohen and the fellows at Sportsology, for their hospitality. We are culminating here tonight 500 hours of the FDH Lounge, and specifically our recent Road to 500 celebration that we've been on these last couple weeks. For those who've been on this journey with us over the course of the last couple of weeks, Bob Barker on the program to talk about the Zanesville animal tragedy. UFC legend Ken Shamrock, our FDH Lounge Pantheon, our examination of the best of the best in all walks of life, our fifth edition of the FDH Lounge Pantheon, and of course last week, legendary rock star Steve Perry giving one of his rare interviews to us. And we're happy to culminate this Road to 500 here tonight with a guest that we very much enjoy. We've had him on the program previously on two different occasions, and he has an excellent touch for being able to break down subject matter that might otherwise seem daunting to a lot of people, myself included. He's got a new book out, and I'm sure this is going to join the ranks of his previous bestsellers, Money and Power, How Goldman Sachs Came to Rule the World. So I could only be speaking here tonight of our guest on the program for the third time, William Cohen, joining us here tonight. William, it's a pleasure to have you on the show. How are you tonight, sir?
I'm doing great. Thank you for having me. What a nice introduction.
Oh, thank you. It's a pleasure to have you back on. I always enjoy these conversations. I feel like they're very enlightening. What I'd like to do in the course of tonight's conversation is to kind of go back and forth between the big picture and Goldman Sachs, because they do seem kind of intertwined, and Goldman Sachs seems very emblematic of the bigger picture as well. I guess we could start just by more or less what we did starting the last time you were on in February. We kind of took a look at where we've been since June of 2009, which was your first edition on our program here. So it seems like at that point in time, we were still kind of recovering. We were still kind of on the brink at that point. February, it seemed as though we were kind of teetering yet again. Where do things sit today? Everybody's very concerned, obviously, about the risks of contagion and debt from Europe and the bomb that might be ticking there. But how do you see things at this moment in time relative to where we've been over the last 3 years?
Well, I mean, it always seems so complicated, doesn't it? I mean,
sure.
There's all this bad news constantly flowing. I mean, you know, you just can't seem to get, you know, we'll go one day without, you know, bad news on some front. I mean, just when you think people, you know, are assimilating the news about MF Global, which is my newest horror story that I've been talking about, you know, you get a situation like, you know, completely different, like there is at Penn State, which is just, you know, tragic as well. I mean, so there's just, and to say nothing of what's going on in Europe, whether it's the Greek government, the Italian government, I mean, who knows where this is going to end. And it's getting really, really scary. I mean, yes, February of 2009 was a very scary time. And then things seemed to improve over the course of that summer and into the next year. The stock market went from about 6,500 on the Dow to close to 12,000. And I think people began to start feeling a little bit better, and you know, I ironically, of course, you know, the stock market is still you know, up at the kind of close to 12,000 level. It was up 112 points today, and yet again, because of what's going on in Europe economically, the incredibly as I say, you know, pathetic stalemate that exists in Washington with our supposedly elected leaders who can't seem to focus on the issues at hand. I mean, yes, there is this supposedly bipartisan congressional panel that we're all sort of waiting to see whether they can solve some of these fiscal problems. And then you get a situation, you know, like MF Global, where you have, you know, John Corzine, who was a former CEO of Goldman Sachs, put in his position at MF Global by Chris Flowers, a former partner at Goldman Sachs, who is supposedly one of the world's best in financial institutions bankers, who owns around 7% of MF Global, or owned it. Now it's completely worthless. They engineered this supposed new strategy at MF Global where they're going to take a lot more risk, and it ends in the tragedy of the firm filing for bankruptcy. Frankly, it's actually being liquidated, so there will be no firm. 3,000 people will lose their jobs. Billions will be lost with creditors. There's $600 million or so that seems to be missing, which is another saga, a part of this story. And then there are all the customers who can't get their money out of MF Global. And so, you know, you have a situation like this, which is something like the sixth largest bankruptcy in American history, and it, with about $40 billion of liabilities. You know, contrast that with Lehman Brothers, which had something like $650 billion. So it's smaller compared to Lehman, but yet still one of the largest in American history. And you know, it didn't have to happen. It was all about, you know, one guy's or two guys' egos, you know, John Corzine's desire to prove that he was, you know, back in the game again after he got fired from Goldman Sachs in 1999. And so I just find that you can never underestimate people's ego-driven behavior in doing things that really are highly, highly destructive to thousands of people's lives and billions of dollars of lost value.
Well, it's interesting, William, because the reasons and motivations might have stemmed from what you just said, but John Corzine has become, at the very same time, it seems to me, a very potent symbol. And there's a notion that's, that I've heard many times over the years about the political spectrum being more of a circle on some issues, at the very least, than it is a straight line. And I know we've seen that on trade issues and other things like that. To the Occupy Wall Street folks, he's just another corporate pig who got greedy and everything. But to folks like myself, the paleocons out there, at least quasi-Tea Party sympathizers like myself, we find something, I think, to bemoan in him also, because he's quite a hypocrite, isn't he? I mean, for somebody who really spent his political career railing against greed and railing against the more fortunate not doing their part, one of the big things it seems to me that this came down to, William, is he thought there was going to be a bailout at the end of the day. He invested so heavily in these risky ventures because he thought there was going to be a bailout, and he was counting on a bailout coming for him and his friends, didn't he?
Well, it's you know, he hasn't said, he hasn't been doing much talking in the last 10 days or so, no surprise. So whether he was counting on a bailout or not, I think more importantly than whether he was counting on a bailout, he probably never even conceived that what he was doing was risky, which is the really scary part. Here's a guy
who
I think he never thought that, even though his firm was leveraged something like 40 to 1, and he had made this $6.3 billion principal bet on sovereign European debt on a sliver of something like $500 million of equity, I mean, which is insane to begin with. And he had rebuffed all regulatory calls over the summer to increase the amount of capital that he had at the firm. I'm sure, knowing John as I do, I don't think he thought this would turn out badly. And in fact, I'm sure he would still say, if he were talking, that he thinks this bet is going to pay off. Which you know, ironically, he could be end up being right. Unfortunately, when the market heard that he was making this bet, they just took their money out and asked questions later. And you know, when the credit rating agencies, who are also, you know, are trying to redeem their horrible behavior during the mortgage crisis, jumped down MF's throat very quickly that final week of October and downgraded them, well, you know, that made it so that all the counterparties that they were doing business with weren't able to demand more collateral, and, you know, it became a, you know, the classic liquidity death spiral that we saw with Bear Stearns and Lehman Brothers and Merrill Lynch and all the rest of them. So the fact that this guy, who had been a former Goldman Sachs CEO and was enabled by one of the world's best bankers and financial institutions, could have so foolishly constructed this extremely risky house on top of a very sliver of equity. Equity Foundation is beyond appalling. I mean, I really, you know, I can almost, as someone who wrote a book about Bear Stearns and why Bear Stearns imploded, I can almost forgive the people at Bear Stearns for failing to have the imagination that their firm, after 85 years, could somehow possibly go out of business. But you know, in the fall of 2011, you know, after seeing what happened to Bear, Lehman, Merrill, AIG, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, you can't possibly, you know, fail to claim to not have understand what was going on or how Wall Street firms finance themselves and how risky that is. And to then take additional risks on top of that, knowing that, is beyond unconscionable. I think it's borders on criminal, criminal negligence.
Yeah, I think most people would agree with you on that. And again, your perspective is very interesting because it's one that I hadn't really heard before, to be honest with you. Everything I've heard has sort of been more on the side of hypocrisy and less on the side of delusion, but perhaps he really did think he would get away with that. You mentioned about Europe, and you mentioned about the debt there, and I understand that there are going to be some aspects of this that are apples and oranges, but for the sake of any of our listeners out there, for breaking it down a little bit, when you've got something like Italy that's tottering, Greece has been for a while, but Italy, we've been hearing in recent days, obviously that much worse because it's that much bigger. How does it compare to what we faced a little over 3 years ago with, first of all, Bear Stearns, which, of course, you've written a book on previously, Lehman Brothers, which is the thing that many people credit for almost taking down the financial system in the fall of 2008. What would something like Italy and the major distress that they could visit upon the world, what would be the similarities and differences from what those two previous chapters did?
Well, that is a, you know, a big question, and it defies sort of an easy answer. I think the thing about the financial institutions that failed in 2008, the thing that really got people scared. I mean, you have to remember, until the Treasury and the Fed orchestrated the bailout of Bear Stearns in March of 2008, there had never been a U.S. government-sponsored bailout of a securities firm. In all the rest of American history, when a securities firm got into trouble, guess what? It got into trouble, and if it couldn't be merged with another firm, it went out of business. Too damn bad. This was the first time that our leaders decided that there was it was just too calamitous, too potentially calamitous, too risky, because of how interconnected Bear Stearns was to all the other big financial institutions on the face of the earth, through counterparty transactions, through derivative transactions, through credit default swaps, through mortgage-backed securities that they had sold. It was too interdependent to fail. That's really what happened. It was too interdependent to fail, and they decided they could not let that happen and that they had to figure out a way to bail it out. And you know what? Interestingly, for a period of time afterwards, after J.P. Morgan agreed to buy it for $2 a share and then $10 a share, you know, the markets did stabilize. And then, of course, what became obvious to everybody is it wasn't really necessarily Bear Stearns per se, although, yes, of course, the way they conducted their business, the amount of leverage that they had put them in an extremely risky position. But it was, frankly, the whole nature of the way Wall Street financed itself, which was borrowing short and lending long. In other words, borrowing in the overnight financing markets and constructing these long-dated bets, which, frankly, was exactly what happened to MF Global. They were in the business of financing themselves in the short-term markets, and then Corzine had constructed this long-term bet, 18-month bet, on the sovereign debt of these countries in Europe that were in trouble. You know, I think that MF Global, being a much smaller firm than Bear Stearns or Lehman or Merrill Lynch, you know, wasn't as interconnected. And I think you'll notice there was not even a discussion of bailing out, as far as I've heard, of bailing out MF Global. There was a discussion of trying to merge them, and when they discovered that these customer funds were missing, you know, the merger partner moved away. So the question is, you know, what's going to happen if any of these sovereign nations fail? Well, first of all, you know, I think this is, you know, we're in a period of brinkmanship, no surprise, in another period of brinkmanship. I think that the plan on the table for Greece, where basically they creditors have to take a 50% haircut on their Greek debt and then sort of somehow get reimbursed, you know, through the IMF or the European Central Bank. I mean, it's not dissimilar to what happened with AIG counterparties. You know, the money went into AIG and then it went out to all the counterparties, in this case 100 cents on the dollar. In this case, you know, with Greece, they'll have to take 50 cents on the dollar, and then whether they get reimbursed by the IMF or the ECB remains to be seen. But I, you know, I have a feeling that, you know, what was happening in Italy might be as much a political as economic at this point. I think in Greece it was clearly economic. The economic catastrophe in Greece then drove the political process. The government failed, and now there'll be a new government, which will hopefully affect the bailout that's been proposed. In Italy, I think it might be, and again, I don't claim to be an expert on this, but it appears to me to be slightly different in that we're really talking about the yields moving up on Italian debt and the market beginning to lose confidence in Italy as they had completely lost confidence in Greece, and the feeling that Berlusconi wasn't going to get the job done, that he was too, you know, entrenched for obvious reasons. I mean, he controls all the media, he controls politics. So, I mean, I think that what's happening there is that in order for the kind of economic reform that needs to take place to prevent Italy from becoming like Greece, you needed to have a change of government, and we'll see if that, in fact, ends up happening. You know, but the problem is, you know, who really owns this European sovereign debt? You know, if people were watching carefully last week, there was a small investment bank named Jefferies and Company that one of the insurgent rating agency companies named Egan Jones put out a report saying that Jefferies had a fair amount of exposure to European debt, and that sent that stock down in a tailspin. It sort of happened right around when MF was filing for bankruptcy, and that, and Jefferies, which is, you know, fairly well-regarded, you know, small investment bank, but again, finances itself the same way in the short-term financing markets, borrows short and lends long. And the fact that they had this bet on European sovereign debt, everybody sort of freaked out, took their money out, the stock went down 20%. They came out and made a statement saying, actually, we've hedged it, and Egan Jones is wrong, and the stock recovered. But that doesn't change how risky this financing model is. And so, you know, you see things like MF Global, you know, making this bet on the sovereign debt and going out of bankruptcy, but not because of necessarily the debt, the bet that they made on sovereign debt. It's because they're the way they finance themselves is so risky. They give their short-term creditors a vote every night about whether to do business with them. That is the flaw. It's not necessarily that they have exposure to European debt. I mean, that can either work out or it cannot work out. And in MF Global's case, it might very well have worked out. But because they were giving a vote every night to their short-term creditors about whether to continue to doing business with them, short-term creditors just said, we're not going to play in this anymore. It's not worth it to us. We're pulling the plug. We don't care. We don't care about MF Global, nor frankly should they. MF Global should not have been financing itself in these short-term markets. Jefferies should not be financing itself in these short-term markets. Yes, it'll cost them more to get longer-term debt, but that's what they need to do so that there isn't this much risk. So I think that it's a function of what happens in Europe is going to affect the people who hold that European credit. And a lot of that is European banks. And we can't get a clear read on how the American banks or the exposure they have. It seems that some of them do have exposure, but they've also hedged themselves. So it's not exactly clear. I don't think, while it would be catastrophic, there's no question about it, it may not have the same level of interconnectedness that Lehman, Bear, Merrill, and AIG had, which became, you know, could have brought down the whole darn thing.
Well, I think that's definitely something people could in this country could hope for selfishly, that you're not going to have a repeat of that happening regardless of what happens in the old world. But it's interesting. We've talked a little bit about MF Global and about John Corzine, who, of course, factors very prominently into your book. Some of the other characters in your book, when you look at 2008, Hank Paulson being the Treasury chief, having come off of running Goldman Sachs, Josh Bolton, who had been high-ranking there, White House chief of staff. So this notion that's out there that your book very it captures very well, the subtitle, how Goldman Sachs came to rule the world, that really is how everyone kind of looks at them, because they came out of this, ultimately, the downturn without a scratch on them, at least financially. And if you look at the bonuses of 2009 and 2010, that kind of tells the tale. Their reputation might be another story because of those bonuses and the resentment. But I've even heard some talk recently, some parodies about Goldman Sachs setting up a global rage fund to try to cash in on Occupy Wall Street. And that's just the image that everyone seems to have of them. And I thought that your book did a very good job of capturing that, and the fact that, you know, it seems to me, and I don't know how good of a thesis this is for the book, but what my takeaway was that it almost seems whatever happens in the world, they're going to come out smelling like a rose.
Well, you know, that's why I thought it was really important to write the full history of the firm, even though it's, you know, it's a very highly entertaining book, but it's not a short book. Because I thought it was really important for people to understand how did they get the way they are. I mean, you know, the first thing is that basically for, you know, the first 140 of the 142-year existence of Goldman Sachs, they were pretty much Teflon in terms of reputation. They were absolutely the gold standard on Wall Street. No matter what Wall Street firm I worked at, we always wanted to be like Goldman Sachs. It was like in the olden days, you know, when they said, you know, you can't go wrong hiring IBM. Well, you know, you couldn't go wrong hiring Goldman Sachs. And, you know, ironically, they became the poster child for the financial crisis, even though they actually, as I tell the story in my book, they actually were the smartest firm on Wall Street. They actually saw the risk that was building in the mortgage market and took steps to make a massive short bet against it. And they came out, as you pointed out, making billions of dollars. In 2007, when the rest of Wall Street was basically imploding, Goldman Sachs made $17 billion pre-tax. In 2009, when, you know, Wall Street was completely on its back, and those that were even, and to say nothing of those that had gone completely out of business, Goldman Sachs made $20 billion pre-tax. So Goldman was kind of raking it in when everybody else was in serious trouble, and that's because they, you know, frankly, have a better handle on how to assess and manage risk than any firm on Wall Street. Now, ironically, that got them into a lot of trouble when it was revealed that they were able to make all this money in 2007, while at the same time betting short against the mortgage market, while at the same time that they also continued to sell mortgage-backed securities at 100 cents on the dollar to investors. So that sort of bifurcated mentality of, on the one hand, seeing trouble in the mortgage market and creating a big bet against it, while at the same time continuing to sell mortgage-backed securities to investors at 100 cents on the dollar, really, I think that sort of conflict of interest, if you will, you know, I guess Einstein was the one who said the ability to hold two opposing thoughts in your head at the same time is a sign of genius. Now, at Goldman Sachs, they revere this as a sign of their genius. But, you know, Senator Carl Levin, when he conducted his hearing in April 2010 that went on all day, I mean, he obviously had the exact opposite view. He thought it was a major conflict of interest and should be considered criminal behavior. So, you know, Goldman became, even though they made it through the crisis in a very clever way, they became the poster child for bad behavior, and they're still the poster child for bad behavior to this day, as you alluded to. Now, in their history, they were constantly in and out of trouble. That's what people don't realize. They were constantly in and out of trouble. And, in fact, they were famously in trouble in 1929 when they created something called the Goldman Sachs Trading Company, which was Goldman's version of a Ponzi scheme. It went up hugely and then came down, and all the investors lost, you know, about 99% of their money. And for 5 years, Goldman Sachs was the butt of jokes. Stand-up comedians would make jokes about Goldman Sachs, not unlike kind of the way, you know, John Stewart makes jokes about Goldman Sachs. So, you know, by that standard, it took them 5 years to get out of the doghouse. And, you know, by that standard, we're about halfway through for them.
Well, so they've got a little bit to go then through this cycle. But in our remaining minute or so available, William, just want to ask you. I know that this book is out. I'm sure it's doing quite well. Money and Power, How Goldman Sachs Came to Rule the World. And, of course, you've got your other writing that's ongoing as far as being a contributing editor of Vanity Fair, columns, New York Times, Financial Times, Fortune, The Atlantic, Washington Post, et cetera. Do you have your next book project targeted already? Are these the things that you think of this far out, or is that something that you're counting on coming to you later on?
Well, I've actually begun mapping that out. It's not and getting it signed up, which is yet to happen, but we're close. But it, basically, the idea is it's not going to be a book about Wall Street per se. It's going to be a book about another institution where you know, there's elements of hubris and of wealth and privilege and greed and sort of bad boy behavior, and the way that all comes together in a little bouillabaisse and you know, causes a lot of trouble and upheaval. So I really like sort of peeling back the onion on institutions, and this will be a similar kind of thing, but not Wall Street. So all those people on Wall Street can be pleased that I'm focusing my attention elsewhere, at least in book form. I will still write plenty of articles and columns about Wall Street bad boy behavior.
Okay, well, you know, and you mentioned earlier on in the show Penn State, and of course with that being in the headlines this week, we've seen that a lot of these elements lend themselves to many different professions, not just those on Wall Street. So we'll look forward to that. And William, as always, we enjoy navigating all of these elements with you and having you sort of be our Sherpa through the world here of finance and business. And it's always a pleasure to get to talk to you, and look forward to doing so again here sometime soon, hopefully.
Well, thank you very much for having me. I always enjoy it.
I appreciate it. Thank you very much, William.
Take care.
All right, William Cohen, everybody, author extraordinaire. We had him on here tonight to discuss his new book, which is, of course, Money and Power, How Goldman Sachs Came to Rule the World. Thanks very much for joining us, everyone. This has been mini episode number 34 of the FDH Lounge. Thanks again to our good friends at Sportsology.